Now it's time for film reviews. Films up for review this evening are The Dead Don't Die, a zombie comedy featuring an all-star cast led by Bill Murray and Tilda Swinton, The Brink, a documentary about the former White House strategist Steve Bannon, and Annabelle Come Home, a supernatural horror based on a demonic doll. I'm joined in studio by Jim McCrae and Chris Wasser, who've been to see all three films. Chris, is this a conventional zombie movie? Because with Jim Jarmusch on board directing, cast of Bill Murray, Adam Driver, Chloe Sevigny, you would think there'd be a bit of a twist.
Yeah, Jim Jarmusch doesn't do conventional. So it's a bit of an odd setup. We're in small town America in a town called Centerville, and we're focusing on a trio of cops. We've got Bill Murray as the chief, Chief Cliff Robertson, Adam Driver as Officer Ronnie Peterson, and Chloe Sevigny as Officer Mindy Morrison. And they're a tad confused about what's going on in this town because strange things are happening. So news reports in the background tell us the polar fracking has led to a shift in the Earth's rotation, and this could have all sorts to dire consequences, but that's not really important. On a, you know, the global stuff isn't important. It's what's happening in this town. The sun isn't going down when it's supposed to. The pets are freaking out. Hermish Bob, the local eccentric madman in the woods, played by Tom Waits, he's warning that things, you know, bad things are going to happen. Even the Undertaker, played by Zelda Swinton, or Tilda Swinton, her name is actually Zelda Winston, she's kind of noticing spooky goings on. And, you know, everyone has this bad feeling. They're right to have a bad feeling because the dead are about to come back to life. There is going to be a zombie invasion.
So will we listen to a clip? So this is a clip from The Dead Don't Die. In this clip, Mindy, played by Chloe Sevigny, seeks comfort from her police officer colleagues, Adam Driver's Ronnie and Bill Murray's Cliff.
Guys, shouldn't we be telling each other that it's all going to be okay? That this will all go away like a bad dream? Ronnie?
Gee, Mindy, I'm not sure I can say that.
Cliff? Please?
It's all gonna be okay, Mindy. Maybe it'll all just go away like a bad dream.
I doubt it.
So that's a clip there from The Dead Don't Die. Why don't the dead die in this town, Gemma?
They do die, but they sort of come back to life and go out of the grave. And when they do, they wander around craving the things that they wanted when they were alive. So instead of the classical call for brains, you're going to get things like Wi-Fi or coffee or Snickers bars. Like,
oh, right. So they're saying the things that they yearn for when they were alive. That's funny, isn't it?
It is in the very beginning, which is what I did feel. There was a lot of humour that because there's so little substance to the narrative, to the structure, to the characters, all the things that are funny and good commentary, they tend to wear very, very thin very quickly.
Yeah.
But Chris, aren't the three cops, Bill Murray and Chloe Sevigny and who's the other cop?
Adam Driver,
Adam Driver. Aren't they all three personality types?
Oh, they really are. And given the right material and given the right director, they do excel. And Bill Murray has worked with Jim Jarmusch before. I think he was in Coffee and Cigarettes too. Adam Driver starred in Jim Jarmusch's last film, Patterson, which was sublime. Another film where not really much happens, but just the performance and the writing was so sharp. With this, it's a bit of a meta zombie comedy that's too meta, and there's not enough comedy. So you can see the idea, you can see what Jim Jarmusch is going for, and you know what this film is really about. I mean, the zombies are craving the things, they're craving their vices that they had when they were alive. So it's clearly Jim Jarmusch is saying, look, you know, the zombie apocalypse is already here. This is what America's already like. Now, he's been actually kicking against the politics because so many critics and audiences have focused on that, and he says, well, that's not what it's really about.
So it's a rant against consumerism.
Oh, it has to be, and it's also a commentary on what's going on in America. I mean, Steve Buscemi's character, he plays this racist farmer Miller, who, you know, doesn't like the fact that his chickens are disappearing, and he wears this cap that says Make America White Again, and his dog's name is Rumsfeld. Jim Jarmusch just didn't throw that into the script just because he thought it would be funny. Clearly this film is trying to say something. Unfortunately, if you've seen the trailer for this and if you've seen the post, everything suggests that you're in for this very funny, bonkers, action-packed zombie comedy, somewhere along the lines of, say, Shaun of the Dead. But everything we've just mentioned about the film, that's it.
But Jim, in the Jim Jarmusch film, you don't expect action. You expect lots of time where people have, if not meaningful conversations, interesting and funny conversations.
And this does deliver those elements of it, but at the same time, it's still tackling the zombie genre. It's an action horror type of film, and it kind of sets it up in the 1950s type of zombie film as well, rather than the modern day zombie film, which is something we've just seen so much that there's nothing even fresh there. So I think what Jim Jarmusch does a lot is he takes a kind of interesting side angle look at this, but this all just seems very surface based and very on the nose. Even the themes are very on the nose and the way they're questioned.
But they have some interesting zombies like Iggy Pop, for example.
Oh yeah, I'll give an extra star just for Iggy Pop as a zombie. That's inspired casting. But unfortunately, you've got too many famous people here, and it's almost like this film... If you've got that cast, you should give them all something to do. But the majority of the cast members, Selena Gomez, Caleb Landry-Jones, Danny Glover, Steve Buscemi, they're given absolutely nothing to do. And there are large portions of this film, and you might expect it again from a Jim Jarmusch joint, but there are large portions of this film where the cast members are literally standing around spelling out what's happening for each other. And that is not interesting to watch. It's not fun. The jokes eventually run out of steam. And also... In the third act as well, the film becomes unbearably smug and very pleased with itself, despite the fact that it is not going anywhere.
So they're having too much fun together making the film rather than entertaining people and making points.
It's that old thing about comedy. If the people involved are having too much fun, then we're going to have less fun.
So how much fun did you have? Stars out of five, Chris.
I did not have an awful lot of fun with this. I thought it was just a half-baked idea that got way out of hand. I'll give an extra star for Iggy Pop as a zombie, so that brings it to two.
Two, so that's not saying much. And you, Gemma?
It was contemptuous of the viewer. It was contemptuous of middle, like small town America.
Yeah.
There was no character arcs. Everyone was one note. And what really irritated me is to have an actress like Chloe play this hysterical, cliched woman who can't do her job because she's too busy getting
has
sick
to vomit and, every time.
Yeah,
yes.
Getting sick and being upset. No, one star. And it's a shame because I had high expectations.
And you're not giving Iggy Pop a second star, no.
No, he's the one star.
So, okay. So that's bad news for The Dead Don't Die. Next up is The Brink. That's Alison Clayman's documentary on Steve Bannon. Chris, remind us if we have forgotten. He has left his job in the White House. Who Steve Bannon is and why is he so controversial?
Yeah, he's a bit of a political and media jack of all trades and a master of none. He's been a media executive with Breitbart News. He was very much involved in helping Donald Trump get into the White House, and then for the first 7 months of Donald Trump's presidency, he was the White House chief strategist. He left in the days following the Charlottesville rally in 2017, and he then went on. I mean, he had already left his mark at that stage. He had actually helped to bring in these, you know, poisonous, you know, far right ideologies and tactics into the U.S. political mainstream, and so afterwards, he thought, well, I don't technically have a job here. He went back to Breitbart, which is this far-right news website, and he also decided to focus his attention on the rest of the world, which was to kind of, you know, go around Europe, start meeting with these far-right politicians and to unify and mobilize, you know, far-right parties across Europe. So Alison Clayman at one stage, who is an acclaimed journalist and a documentary maker, she was granted this unbelievable, unparalleled access to Steve Bannon, who invited her on board and said, you can spend the next 15 months with me basically documenting every move I make.
So her politics don't seem to chime with his. So why would he make this decision to go with her? Or is he unashamedly what he is?
He's a very interesting and complex character, and I don't even know if he knows why he does that. He grants the liberal media so much access to him. So you even see him having conversations with the Guardian journalists, with the author of that really famous book that came out of Fire and Fury. You see him have these long interviews and spend his whole life sitting down talking to these characters.
He also talks to like-minded people. Let's have a listen to this clip where he talks to Nigel Farage about how similar they are.
We're fire breathers. I mean, we're taking on the establishment every day. You've taken on the Tory party. Yep. I'm taking on the Republican party. Yep. They don't have that. And that's why we can steal a march on them. And the reason they don't want to do it, it's immigration. As long as they don't take on the immigration, they just refuse to take on the immigration. We're prepared to take it on.
Yes.
It's a global revolt. It's a zeitgeist. We're on the right side of history, but it's going to need the motive power. And the thing that's missing is that's what I'm really trying to put together now is the ideas. The ideas have to come in more sharp focus. The economic ideas, the political ideas.
You've also moved, Steve, into a different place.
Yeah.
The minute you stood up on that stage in Alabama, you became a different figure.
Yeah.
You're in a different place now. You're not just fixing stuff and operating behind the scenes and making it happen.
Yeah.
You're now the face of it.
So Steve Bannon and Nigel Farage having a bit of a love in there on In the Brink. You started to say there that you do relate to Steve Bannon. There is a very personable side to him.
I was so surprised by how engaging and warm and folksy he is. Now, one of the things that Alison alludes to in this film is that it's all an act, that it is quite a charming veneer and that he can do that. But he is presented as someone who's kind and warm and thoughtful, like even in the way he engages with her. And then you get a sense of his true thoughts. So one of the things he does is he never explicitly says he's a Nazi sympathizer who really respects those ideals. But you really get a sense of him enjoying other people knowing that that is the case. And she has one moment where she's calling him out and he's sneering at the camera going, no, that's not, you know, that's not what I am. But his eyes are like, yeah, that is exactly what I am. And I know you know. So I wonder, does he like...
But Chris, do you think that there might be two people? There might be the cozy, folksy personality who just seems to have extreme right-wing views.
Potentially. I mean, that might explain why he wears two shirts all the time. I couldn't get my head around that at all.
Two shirts.
He wears two shirts at the same time. He wears a polo shirt under a dress shirt, which is just... ludicrous. Anyway, focusing on the wrong things. He's known as Steve T-shirt Bannon. But no, I don't know if it is. I mean, he epitomizes the whole, I'm not racist, but, you know, everything. He tries to deny what he is, but it's there for you to see. The great thing about this documentary is that Alison Klayman, you know, clearly her politics do not match up with Steve Bannon's, but she keeps to the background. So what we're getting is this observational approach. And because she has this, because she's been granted access to not just, you know, Steve Bannon working in his office or on private jets or in private airports, which he knows himself, he doesn't come across very well if he's being filmed in all of these expensive places. Because she's also granted access to the meetings, you're seeing him in every different form. And I do think that I don't know what he thought he was going to get out of this, or if people have, you know, there is this charming side to him, but I also came away going, he's just such an odious charlatan.
But it's came in very much in the background, because I thought you said, Gemma, that she gives her commentary on him.
She chimes in, she'll push him for questions, and you can see at the beginning she obviously is trying to maintain a distance, and she's observing him from the sidelines, and maybe it is as the relationship builds, because it's a very chronological documentary. She starts calling him out and she starts questioning him.
Yeah.
Did you see how popular he was, though? Did you see him amongst big crowds of people? Because there is a huge groundswell of support for his views and his politics.
Absolutely. Even when he's, especially when he's on home turf and he's, you know, you've got people queuing up and chomping at the bit to take photographs with him. And he has this little thing that he does where he stands in between two people and he says the same thing over. He's dedicated to his cause anyway. And he says, like, oh, I'll stand in the middle of the rose between two thorns. And everybody wants to shake his hand and to hug him and to tell him how much, you know, they're behind him.
And what's he saying? We've cleared the swamp, or what is he saying to them?
He's very talented at talking a lot without really saying anything. And I mean, it's so strange that he doesn't like Trump and Trump doesn't like him, and yet they're playing for the same team.
And does he say that now?
Yeah, well, actually, he doesn't dig too much into Trump. He says a couple of things, and it does remind you of there were comments in Fire and Fury, wasn't there?
Yeah, and he was still, like, that's when Trump called him Sloppy Steve in the tweet, and you can see he's actually still campaigning for Trump, and he's still speaking out, like, various events promoting Trump and having a very expensive and probably very terrible film made about Trump to try and get him in. But yet, obviously, there's no love lost between the two men.
Yeah.
So let's listen to another clip. This comes back to what you were saying about if he has or has not got Nazi sympathies. Steve Bannon is confronted here by the Guardian journalist Paul Lewis about who he associates with in Europe.
Some of the people you're doing business with here in Europe are, you know, far right, sometimes quite extreme, sometimes they've got links to...
Like Orban or who?
Like Philippe de Winter, who you had a meeting with in London?
No, he just came, that was a general dinner.
Does it concern you that Philippe de Winter is like commemorated former SS collaborators?
No. That kind of stuff is not going to be tolerated in the movement. We were very upfront with that, right? So he just came to the dinner. That was a general dinner. We had, you know, a number of people there.
What about Kent Ekeroth in Sweden? I mean, he has been ostracized by the Sweden Democrats. He's not even on their list of parliamentary candidates.
He came to the introductory dinner too.
Who was the other person at the dinner?
Yeah, I mean, there's like 15 or 20 people at the dinner.
I mean, people will find it deeply offensive, particularly Jews who live in Europe.
Jews who lived in Italy. Hang on, Michael happens to be Jewish. Michael's Jewish.
Let me just say what Errol Morris said. He said, Steve Bannon will doubtlessly say that his remarks were not anti-Semitic, but I would respectfully disagree. He knew what he was doing. He's suggesting that you're doing dog whistle anti-Semitism here. That's your modus operandi.
I just disagree with Errol on that.
That's Paul Lewis of The Guardian putting questions to Steve Bannon in The Brink. Gemma, overall, what did you think?
Oh, fabulous. So of the three films, and if I was to recommend them, I would recommend going to see this three times. I actually want to watch it again because I know there's so much that I missed. And again, because it's so... It doesn't spell anything out. He's so complex. It's just a very interesting watch.
So stars out of five.
Four.
Four out of five. And for you, Chris?
Yeah, I thought it was great. It can be difficult to watch and quite awkward at times, but it's quite engaging. It's a terrific piece of journalism. It's also worth the cinema ticket just to see the great Paul Lewis really dig into Steve Bannon. I'd have watched the whole film if it was made up of just interviews between the two of them. So, four stars.
Four stars from both of you for The Brink. Finally, we have Annabelle Comes Home. The demonic doll is back in the seventh installation from the Conjuring universe. So, Gemma, can you bring us into the Conjuring universe and tell us about Annabelle and how does she show up in this film?
Of course. So Ed and Lorraine Warren, they're the two familiar characters that we know throughout the whole series. We meet them in the very beginning and they are taking this very, very creepy doll back home in their car. They have a spooky incident where they have a run-in with a load of ghouls and then they realise how dangerous this doll is. What they do then is they lock her in a magic case in their basement with a load of other artifacts and then they keep her down there. And really the action kicks off 4 years later when their daughter Judy is being babysat by the very, very wholesome babysitter Mary Ellen. Now they have an evening of making cakes and playing planned until Daniel Rios, their Mary Ellen's kind of naughty friend, comes in and she decides to charm them, distract them, and go down to the basement. And while she's down there, she interacts with a load of those kind of creepy objects and ultimately lets Annabelle out of her case, which is where the mayhem ensues.
All right. And then how does the mayhem ensue, Chris?
Well, Annabelle's a haunted, creepy toy that you should never go near. And I look, the details aren't important. She's evil. And when Annabelle is let out of her magic sacred box, this malevolent spirit is released and it, you know, basically bands together with all the other sinister souvenirs and other malevolent spirits in this artifacts room in the Warren's basement. And they all just start to freak the bejesus out of basically, you know, Judy and her babysitter. So it's all set over the one night. So it's this sort of kind of, it's actually this really weird home invasion thriller that's kind of dressed up as a supernatural horror. And of course, the two people that could help the kids are Ed and Lorraine Warren, but they're away on a business trip helping someone else.
Okay, we have a clip. I've forgotten what it's called. I think it's when a truck becomes demonic.
I'm so sorry. All of a sudden, it was like somebody took over my truck. I had no control. Are you okay?
I'm fine.
It's the doll, Ed. It's a beacon for other spirits.
So that's the parents there, and that's on their way home with the doll. So that's their first inkling that doll needs to be sealed in a box.
Yes. So they're, again, their kind of expert demonology files are all down in the basement and we see the work that they really do. There's a lot, what this film is funny for is the baddies. There's loads of them. They're sort of ridiculous and quite like small characters, and the way that they interact with the main characters in itself is quite playful.
You said, Chris, I think that you either go for the baddies or the goodies in films like this.
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever watched a horror film before, you kind of know that if, you know, silly people go messing around with things that they shouldn't, they deserve everything that's coming to them. But the weird thing about the Conjuring films is that I tend to go for both, because the Conjuring films are good at one thing, which is they are it's very entertaining to watch these silly people who have been touching things they shouldn't in, you know, the Warren's artifacts room get, you know, spooked and haunted by all of these freaky ghouls. I mean, they you know, the scares come first in these films. The story, even though the stories are often rooted in real life, they're actually based on real life characters. I mean, the Warrens are very real people, but the story is a faraway second. So I did have some fun with the scares here. I thought for the first time in seven films, because we are seven films deep with the Conjuring universe, that's the name, I didn't just give it that, they actually decided to, let's not make a Ghost Train film here. James Wan is the director of the previous Conjuring films. He's actually in a sort of a Godfather role with this one. Let's not do the whole usual, like a jump scare every 5 minutes or every 30 seconds. Let's pile on the tension, pile on the dread, and, you know, when the audience least expects it, then, you know, Annabelle will come jumping out of the corner.
And did that work better?
And that actually worked a little bit better. There were moments in this film which I thought, okay, that's genuinely unnerving. We are getting a bit of an atmosphere going here. The only problem is the landing. I mean, the third act of this film, it's just, it's non-existent. It builds and it builds, and there's this terror and dread, and there's a few decent fights in there, and then everything is wrapped up in a bow. Without giving anything away, it just finishes. And I found that very disappointing.
Did it peter out for you?
I actually thought that the pacing was all over the shop the other way around, where I felt there was so much action and scariness in the beginning and the interaction that we heard earlier. And then you cut back to a lot of domesticity and a lot of conversations about feelings and character development and feeling and, you know, people feeling unhappy. And then about 40 minutes or so in, you know, a cup falls off a table and we're supposed to be terrified at that. That for me. And then the terror kind of ramped up too quickly, and they kept the characters apart, which I a little bit too artificially for me. I didn't love the pacing for this. Again.
Now, Jim, I know you gave all your stars to The Brink. How many are you going to give to Annabelle Comes Home?
I'll give it two.
Two out of five for you.
It was two or one.
It's a lot of moaning and groaning, Chris.
I think these films are actually, they're okay, semi-decent starting points for the films that they're clearly borrowing and stealing from. And they're well made. They're actually made, even though they're major studio horrors, they're actually made on very small budgets. But look, it's glossy. It's got a few decent prices.
I'm expecting a very high score.
No, wait, a very high score for the Conjuring films. It's better than The Nun. Three stars.
Three stars, so three and two out of five. My thanks to Chris Wasser and Jim McRae. The Dead Don't Die and Annabelle Comes Home are on general release, and The Brink is on limited release.